And for anyone listening who doesn't know what tempeh is, I probably should explain, because I find that there are people, a lot of people actually, that aren't familiar with it. It's a delicious superfood. It's incredibly high in protein and nutrients. It's fermented, so it's good for your gut. And it's made of just three simple, clean ingredients: soybeans, vinegar, and starter culture. So people need to eat it.
In this episode of Voices from the Field, INCAT Sustainable Agriculture Specialist Chris Lent has a conversation with Sarah Speer of Tootie's Tempeh in Biddeford, Maine. INCAT and two other organizations, Healthcare Without Harm and the Plant Forward Future Project, partnered to form a producer cohort in the Northeast to develop and market plant-based proteins to hospitals. The project is funded by a USDA Specialty Crop Block Grant, and Sarah is part of the producer cohort. She and Chris talk about sourcing beans from organic farms, using worker-owned cooperatives as a business model, manufacturing tempeh, and marketing plant-based proteins to both consumers and hospitals. They also get into strategies for helping plant-based protein food companies thrive in the Northeast. Let's listen.
Hello, I'm Chris Lent, Sustainable Agriculture Specialist with NCAT and the ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Project. I'm based in Pennsylvania, and I'm part of NCAT's Northeast Regional Office. Today, I'll be speaking with Sarah Speer, a founder of Tootie's Tempeh in Biddeford, Maine. And this is a small upstart tempeh production company sourcing from organic farmers in the region. And we'll be talking about the issues involved in taking local organically grown products and producing plant-based proteins for local and regional markets, and also the possibilities of marketing those proteins to institutions like hospitals and so forth. Welcome, Sarah, to our podcast. I'm really happy to have the chance to talk with you today. Thanks for being here with us.
Oh, thanks, Chris. It's really a pleasure to be here with you.
All right. To start with, could you give us an introduction to yourself and to Tootie's Tempeh? Tell us a little about, maybe a little about your background and how the idea for Tootie's Tempeh materialized. You know, maybe even a little about, you know, how the name came about, because it's a very cool name.
Thank you. Well, I've spent my career sort of bouncing between being a food entrepreneur and running social cause nonprofits. But I had Tootie's was really developed because of my previous experience starting and leading a consumer foods company previously. And I always knew I wanted to do another one, but I also knew I wanted to do it quite differently, this time guided by my values to support the well-being of people, animals, and the planet. So with those values, I knew that the product would be plant-based, and I also knew it would be an essential food, a need and not a want, because I didn't want to put more sort of packaging into the world. Mm-hmm. And so an essential food that supported the health and well-being for all. So mm-hmm. I chose tempeh. So there was a lot of thinking that went in before even choosing tempeh, but I chose it, number one, because I loved it, and number two, because I viewed it as a sleeping giant ready to be woken up. Plant-based proteins are, as you know, skyrocketing, and consumers are eating more for their health and to decrease their carbon footprint. So it really seemed like the right time to help tempeh become like a household staple. And for anyone listening who doesn't know what tempeh is, I probably should explain, because I find that there are people, a lot of people actually, that aren't familiar with it. It's a delicious superfood. It's incredibly high in protein and nutrients. It's fermented, so it's good for your gut. And it's made of just three simple, clean ingredients: soybeans, vinegar, and starter culture. So people need to eat it. Anyway, during our research of the industry, we looked at everything through the lens of our values. And that led us to decide to do tempeh and our business a bit differently. First, when we discovered that all US commercial tempeh was fermented in single-use plastic bags, we were kind of shocked. And we decided an easy way, or not, it wasn't easy, but to differentiate and to improve the quality and taste of the product would be the first to ferment it without the plastic bags. And after 2.5 years of R&D, that is what we did. We figured out how to ferment with metal pans instead of plastic bags. And I can proudly say our tempeh has 50% less plastic than all other US brands. So it's a big step forward. And we do still have to vacuum seal the product to keep it fresh in one layer of single-use plastic. And we have found a supplier that does recyclable plastic bag that we're hoping that we can switch over to in time. The second thing we're doing differently is we felt it was important to bring this non-plastic innovation as well as our local sourcing ethic to consumers across the US, and that we would do this by not building a big plant and shipping across the country, which is what my previous company did, but through a network of franchised production facilities where each one would source their beans locally. Consumer buys tempeh, they know they're supporting their local organic farmers and suppliers and workers and communities. And finally, we would be a worker-owned co-op to help support a more democratic economy where workers are the decision makers and share in the profits, and where supporting local farmers and suppliers is implicit in how we do business, with the goal of positively impacting workers, communities, and Mother Earth. So that's the story of Tooties. And the name Tooties was my mom's nickname. She was an entrepreneur herself and a composer and an all-around creative spirit and an environmentalist who was an early supporter of Rachel Carson. And in general, she really liked to rock the boat. She was quite a character. That's where the name came from. And actually the logo with the face with the sunglasses is my mother. She never took her sunglasses off.
Wow.
So kind of fun little story.
Yeah, she sounds like an inspirational character. And it's really nice to have her honored in that way with the name of the company.
Thanks.
And it's neat to see how well aligned the types of things you're doing in your company are with the values that you hold. And could you maybe talk about, you know, exactly the products you do produce and maybe a little of the production process and your facility a little bit as far as how the facility works and the production process through your facility?
Sure. So right now, in the beginning, we're going to focus right on one product, the traditional tempeh, which is just plain soy. Then we will be adding more pre-spiced. We've developed an Italian seasoned one that you can make unbelievable meatballs out of, or just throw it in your spaghetti sauce. We call the meatballs great balls of tempeh. And then another one that's going to have caraway in it that makes a delicious tempeh Reuben, which is a very popular way to serve tempeh in restaurants and delis and things like that. But it also, it can be used, you know, for other things as well, like a boiled dinner or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have marinated products as well in the future. We have a lot of fun, creative ideas. Making tempeh, we have a 2,000 square foot facility in an old mill, the Pepperell Mill in Biddeford. It's a 2-day production process. So you begin by milling the beans, which means splitting and dehulling them. And then you soak and cook them in a big kettle. And then they get dried in a centrifuge, which is like this huge spinning machine. And then you mix in the starter culture and vinegar in a tumbler, And then the beans are ready to be fermented. We pour them into the pans and put them in a climate controlled chamber. And it takes 24 hours for them to ferment. So the second day is all about cooling and cutting and package. It's all packaging, basically. We do pasteurize or heat treat our tempeh so that it has a long shelf life. It has a shelf life of 8 to 10 weeks. If we didn't do that, it would only be fresh for 4 or 5 days. And that just can't really market a product like that in stores. So yeah, that's the story.
Okay. Production. Yeah. Yeah. That's a kind of a shorter window of production than I was even envisioning of producing that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a little bit, but it is really good to learn how that's made. Do you know of other types of, I know you're focusing right now on the tempeh, the soy-based tempeh. Do you know of other types of beans or peas that are grown in the Northeast region that can be used for plant-based protein products?
Yeah.
And would you ever consider using those? Or
The great thing about tempeh is it can be made of sort of any legume, any bean. It can be made of rice, peanuts. I mean, I've seen people ferment corn. It's fun. I mean, you're basically, this mycelium is growing across a substrate of some sort of carbohydrate so we tried the split yellow beans, the field peas that grow in Maine. They use it as a cover crop. And we're going to try them again. The first try didn't come out very well. I think we maybe overcooked the peas. And we're in touch with the farmer to get this year's crop to try again, because we would love to do a non-soy version. Even though soy is, I don't know why it has a bad name. It's all the research on soy has debunked the claims that I think someone from some other industry was trying to malign soy. There's certainly that this processed soys that are used in processed foods are not healthy. But anyway, so we will be looking at different beans. There are like heirloom beans that grow in Maine, like cattle beans. They're used for baked beans, I think, and others, Marfax. We've tried a lot of them. The only problem for us is that they aren't grown in large scale, and so their cost is astronomical for our production. And for, you know, but we will do craft batches in the future using beans like that, because we really do want to support farmers as much as we can in our region.
Right. So it sounds like it is possible to make these products. It's just a matter of having the supply.
Exactly.
Right. To switch gears a little bit, you talked about the worker-owned cooperative structure that you chose to align with some of the values that you have towards your people that are working with your business. Could you talk a little about how that's structured, a little more detail, and why you think it's a important, why it was important to you to go that route as a local producer in your area?
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's hard not to be looking at other ways of doing business in today's business climate, given the inequity between workers and top management. It's in the news all the time. And it's really encouraging to see the growth and increased interest in co-ops, as well as unions strengthening again. So, I mean, co-ops offer an alternative and a solution to our broken economic system, I think. I mean, they focus on building a sustainable business that's going to be here for years to come and will benefit workers and communities, and instead of a quick exit, which shareholders and investors want, and big salaries and packages for top management, which is kind of the norm. I mean, it seemed like an obvious choice to become a worker-owned cooperative because our values were completely aligned. In fact, we used our values and the co-op principles as a guide in decision-making, how we operate the business, how we work together and support each other, you know. So, and it's actually opened doors for us regionally and locally in terms of our distributor. Like, our distributor used to be a worker-owned co-op and then transferred to being a B Corp, but their values are still very much aligned. And stores, especially consumer-owned food co-ops, I mean, they're clamoring to work with us because of Principle 6, so, and just because of our product. But I mean, there's a lovely synergy that goes on. And one of the biggest benefits to being a co-op is because we're dedicated to sourcing locally, we've developed really nice relationships with vendors and farmers around the state, and by doing that, we're supporting our local and regional economy. And yeah, so it feels good to be really, you know, executing on our values.
Yeah, that's all good stuff. I was wondering specifically with your background in as being a food entrepreneur, and you've had other businesses, you probably have seen the issue of turnover. Is this something that helps with that as well, employee turnover?
I mean, our companies, we just hired our first two employees.
I see.
But they both were attracted and wanted to work for us because we were a worker-owned co-op. That was one of the main, you know, it was a big contributing factor. And then statistically, people who are worker owners stay longer because they have a stake. They have a say. They're sharing in profits. There's a and they can help shape the direction if they don't like something. So I think that during COVID, the resilience of co-ops was really shined a light on the difference between a co-op and a traditional business, because they really survived and thrived in many cases because of the co-op structure. Yeah. And we were able to find people immediately. As soon as we posted them, we found really highly qualified people. So yeah, I think it's a benefit.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, that does make a lot of sense. And with the labor issues that a lot of organizations and companies are having, it sounds like it's going to be helpful, very helpful in that way to you as well as aligning with all your other values that you want for the business. You're focused on sourcing from local sources, and you touched on this already as far as some of the sources that you use. But what's been some of the issues that you've had, or some of the maybe the positives and challenges that you've had working with local producers?
Yeah, it's tough. It gets tough for everyone, but our local farmers and producers, they have supply chain, you know, related issues and the shortage of qualified labor. Those are national issues, but I think our farmers are up in Aroostook County, which is, you know, sparsely populated, and it's, they can't even find qualified mechanics and repair people to come and work on their equipment because they don't exist, and they have to come from far away, and they're so overbooked. So, you know, I think that's a big issue. And, but, you know, on the positive side, we've found their pricing to be incredibly competitive going outside of the state, and their qualifications are top notch. We've found an incredible precision metal fabricator 1 mile from our facility. And we had been working with a vendor from Washington State, and we, lo and behold, a mile from us was a more qualified vendor who can actually make our pans more precisely. So that, things like that have been really, really great. the biggest issue, I think, for Maine, for local agriculture producers, is a lack of infrastructure and financial support to enable growth. And I know the state and the state office of the USDA, they've been addressing this and trying to get more money flowing. But it's definitely an issue. Our farmers growing more organic soybeans to keep up with the growing demand, but that's just one farmer. There need to be many more farmers growing them around the state. And there is equipment that they all need to improve their processing capabilities, and they all need more space for processing and storage of raw materials. And these are very prevalent problems, you know. And there is a group that's trying to bring producers and farmers and distributors together to tackle these challenges. There's no one really taking ownership of this problem right now.
Right, right. It seems like a gap. And even when those issues are tackled head on, it seems the change is slow sometimes and advances are slow, but that seems like an opportunity too.
Yeah, there was a grant program recently that was from the recovery money that had $20 million, and they anticipated getting maybe 80 to 100 applicants, and they got over 800 applicants for the $20 million. And many of them were for some of this large scale improvements that need to happen. So they weren't cheap. I mean, they were in the millions and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they ended up only being able to give grant money to 64 farmers and producers. Mm-hmm. And at that, none of them got their full funding. So mm-hmm. But what it did was show them the need is yeah. so strong.
NCATS Soil for Water connects you with farmers, ranchers, and land managers who are discovering practical ways to catch and hold more water in their soils. Find their stories of success, practical tips for soil health, and more at soilforwater.org.
You talked a bit about some of the equipment and other problems in the supply chain kind of prior to your manufacturing process there. What about when we get back to your facility, what kind of issues with, you touched on labor a little bit, you touched on the pans that you have manufactured locally now. What other parts of the manufacturing process and equipment or labor have been hurdles or the positives and challenges involved with that closer to your facility, getting your facility up and running?
Yeah, I mean, we're launching in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And we were supposed to launch like a year ago. So we've definitely had a lot of delays related to COVID and mm-hmm. supply chain and worker shortage. It was very difficult. And then we've even had manufacturers not make the product to spec after, you know, you wait and wait and wait to get the product, and then it comes and they've messed up. All those things that can go wrong, did go wrong. And then it's taken us time to do the R&D to innovate this production process that hadn't been done before. And that's a lot of testing. We made a lot of tempeh, like over 160 batches. So yeah, so it just, that has been just challenges from every angle.
Yeah.
But we've found that the market is really hungry for our tempeh, that they want a locally sourced, organic, plant-based food. And there's been some pent-up demand. No one else has been offering what we offer, and so we're filling a void. And we were able to get, a fantastic distributor, and we've been holding off on getting other distributors just because in the beginning we just want a smooth launch and to work out, any kinks and things before expanding our reach. And so our distributor is Crown of Maine, and they distribute throughout New England, actually, and focus on just locally sourced Maine produce and products that are from Maine organic farmers and producers.
If we could switch to your markets a little bit more, you just touched on it, but what would you consider your target markets to be, or your, I guess, in terms of marketing lingo, marketing, your marketing mix as far as where you're going, who you're focusing on as far as selling these things to?
We decided early on that our primary market would be wholesale to retail stores through distributors. And we don't plan on selling direct to consumers. It's just two different beasts. And we really want to do what we do really well. And then part of that is, in addition to the retail, is to also market to restaurants. We've had a lot of restaurants reach out to us already, and they want to, you know, use our tempeh in their menus. And so we're going to help hopefully build our brand by having them say on the menu that it's Tutti's tempeh, local tempeh. We also want to host some chef cook-offs. There's some great chefs. We're a foodie. Biddeford is an up-and-coming. I just was listed one of the top 10 cities in the country to watch, and Portland, of course. So there are a lot of incredible chefs. We want to do some chef cook-offs, challenging them with the best tempeh recipes, and also to do some online cook-alongs to help people learn how easy and fun it is to cook with tempeh. And we had planned on distributing to institutions like hospitals and universities after we had a handle on our first tier market. But then we got involved in the Plant Forward project that you guys are doing, and we jumped on board because there is such a disconnect with hospitals and the food they serve their patients and staff. I mean, these are places of healing and health, and yet they provide many unhealthy foods, often foods that like contribute to the conditions that brought people to the hospital in the first place. So anyway, the programs like Plant Forward are helping them to start to take steps to address this dichotomy. And we would love to be part of that solution.
Yeah, that's it. It's wonderful. And it's wonderful to have you as part of this. We've learned some things from the Plant Forward project and others like it. Namely, there's, you know, issues and hurdles to marketing products like yours to hospitals and to other institutions. You know, hospitals purchase largely from distributors and they usually won't work directly with small local suppliers, but you seem to be positioned well using a distributor, or at least getting experience with using a distributor to kind of head in that direction. Pricing can also be an issue, we've learned, of course, to competitively price it, but still have a profit. And it's also challenging sometimes to process and package the product in a way that fits, you know, into the hospital's food preparation systems and into their menus. What are these some of the things you've thought about when thinking about selling to hospitals? What are some of your considerations when you think about marketing to hospitals and other institutions?
Yeah, you've really nailed all the hurdles for sure. Yeah, there is a distributor in Maine. I think it's Sodexo that does distribute to universities and hospitals. We've had preliminary meetings with them, and I think once we have a story to tell from Crown of Maine, that will hopefully fall into place. We do already have a bulk size offering that restaurants also acquire, and it saves us a little bit of money because we don't have to package in our paperboard box. Also, our production manager is a certified plant-based nutritionist, and he can work with any hospital head chef to suggest recipes and work with whatever they're already working with, whatever they've got. So he's a real asset in that respect, and an ally really for the hospital. And if a hospital gets on board with the health benefits of plant-based foods, which is what you're trying to do and consumers are demanding, then we should be able to get their ear as having one of the most high protein, clean, and nutrient dense foods. And the fact that that tempeh cooks and has a texture like meat and is an easy meat replacement, I think are working in our favor. The pricing, it's an interesting challenge. I mean, we are more expensive. And so to penetrate that barrier, the hospital needs to want to support locally sourced and locally made foods and use that as kind of a promotion of sorts that shows that they care about their community and farmers. And, I mean, the great thing about tempeh is that because it is so protein and nutrient dense, you don't need to eat a lot of it to get all of its benefits. So a little will go a long way in terms of nutrition and calories. That's another thing we can work with educating them on. And then we will offer bulk pricing and hope that gets us through the door along with these other things, and then let the tempeh taste and nutrition do the rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let the product sell itself, so to speak. But it does sound like you've put a lot of thought into it, and you're positioning yourself to be able to talk to these hospitals, build relationships, and you've got some good assets in your corner with the nutritionists on staff and your wholesale experience all that you will have already working through distributors. So it'll be really interesting to see how things progress in that direction. I just wanted to mention a couple of resources that ATRA has, ATRA Publications. We have a Tips for Selling to Institutional Markets publication. And we also have a Farm to Healthcare tip sheet, Procuring Local Food and Improving Health tip sheet. Those are both ATRA Publications, and they'll be put in the episode notes for any of our listeners that want to access those resources. I wonder what cooperative effort would you like to see more of in the Northeast in plant-based food supply chain, basically, that would help all involved? I know that's a general question, and you talked about some relationship building to some extent, but what would you like to see happen cooperatively in the supply chain that could help?
I love this question. It's like music to my ears. I mean, if there was a forum that could bring us all together on a regular basis, it would be a great way to share needs, successes, challenges, you know, build relationships and establish a collaborative way to address our common issues. Because that we're all, I mean, I'm very friendly with other, soybean, there's a miso maker and then a tofu maker, Heiwa Tofu. And we are in touch all the time, trying to find ways to encourage farmers to grow more soybeans and the quality of the beans and the equipment for sorting and you know, all those things. So we're all in this together. So joint marketing, large scale grants, and communication efforts that share about our crop growing needs and all of our challenges with all, you know, sharing those with our stakeholders, all those things would help tremendously.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't know who would do this. That's the question. Who is the right, you know, kind of steward?
To bring it all together. Those are excellent ideas. To kind of wrap things up, what would be your advice to give to those who are trying to start a business like yours in the Northeast? I know you envision yours as a expanding into many different regions across the country eventually. But in the Northeast, what would you say would be your advice for someone thinking about a business like yours?
Well, I would say do it. we need you. I mean, we're a movement, and the stronger we are together, the more we can impact the systems that need to be changed. You know, but being an entrepreneur is not for everyone. So I think you need to make sure that you have, you know, all the qualities for that, or at least surround yourself with other people. If you don't, you have to have grit. You got to be nimble, and you really, most importantly, have to have a passion for your product and service. It's going to take you through the ups and downs. And I would also suggest talking with other, in my case, other food entrepreneurs before doing anything, so you can go in with your eyes wide open, and then know that there are many options for structuring your business. I mean, how big a business do you want it to be? And, you know, are you going to make things in your basement or barn, or are you going to, you know, just all those questions that have to do with the quality of life and what, you know, what you're trying to achieve. It's a great place to be an entrepreneur in the Northeast. There's so many resources to support you if they decide to take the leap. In the food world, there are incubator kitchens, there's social impact investment organizations, there's grants for innovation in sustainable and local agriculture, there are university programs that support you, there's manufacturer support, and then there's so many nonprofits that are doing advocacy and education in support of if you're a social cause, you know, business, and general business support for entrepreneurs that will point you in the direction of all these resources. So I say go for it.
Well, if that doesn't tip the scale in favor of it for those who are on the fence thinking about starting a business like this, I don't know what will. You make a good argument for it. I really want to thank you for talking to me today, and all that you've talked about and all your insights into producing locally sourced plant protein based products for local markets. You are a wealth of information on this, and I really appreciate you taking the time and talking with us about this. And I wish you all the luck with getting your business off the ground, and I'm sure we'll be we'll continue to communicate with you and see how things are going. Thank you, and it's much appreciated you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks. Take care.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Additional information about this episode and related resources can be found at atra.incat.org. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Voices from the Field wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Rich Myers. ATRA, Voices from the Field, is produced by the National Center for Appropriate Technology, headquartered in Butte, Montana. It's supported by the USDA Rural Business Cooperative Service as part of NCAT's ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Program. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this recording are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDA or NCAT. We'll catch you again next week, and until then, keep on farming.